Hi, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Signal Sciences, which is a part of Fastly these days. And instead of booking an interview with one of its staff, they suggested we interview one of its customers. So this week's sponsor guest is JJ Agar, who is the CISO of Compass, the American real estate website. He'll be joining us to talk about his general approach to things. And Signal Sciences, obviously a big part of that. But he'll also speak to automation and orchestration and a bunch of other stuff too. That's interesting stuff. And it is coming up after this week's news segment with Adam Boileau, which starts now. And Adam, I can't believe I get to use this sound twice in 2 weeks, but what are we going to talk about?
Let's say China.
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 It's all about China in the front part of this week's show. The United States and, what is it, something like 30 other countries have pulled on their cranky pants and issued a sternly worded statement.
Yes, China has been told that some of its activity in the cyber realms is contrary to its stated goals to be a world leader and is unacceptable. And, you know, this, you know, we've seen obviously China doing a bunch of bad stuff, you know, for a long time in the cybers, and sternly worded letters are certainly one way to address it. But, you know, this is a whole bunch of countries putting out a coordinated release, and, you know, some countries that wouldn't traditionally have gotten on that bandwagon quite so fast. I mean, New Zealand, for example. We don't often say bad things about China for trade reasons. Similarly, you know, Australia's been doing a bit more of that lately, but a whole bunch of European Union countries some sternly worded messages.
Yeah, specifically they're calling out the Exchange of Palooza hacks. That's what we called them anyway, the Hafnium stuff. They also, interestingly enough, the statement from the US government, from the US side, says that they were conducting or you know, people aligned with MSS or whatever were conducting ransomware attacks. I think they're just referring to that trash ransomware that didn't really work that was deployed against some of those exchange boxes. But there's a whole bunch of stuff in here. Separately, they've indicted four MSS operators, right? And also released a bunch of information about Chinese intrusions into critical infrastructure in the United States dating back about 10 years.
Yes, I've been seeing some, you know, the government kind of follow up some attribution there. You know, we're in the private sector, we've certainly seen pretty concrete, you know, statements about who did what. But yeah, having the government put their stamp on that does give us some pretty solid data points to then, you know, when you're attributing other actions in the future, to be able to go back and say, hey, this was, you know, attributed to a government by another government, and we've got some kind of more concrete data points than, you know, when it's all private sector and everyone's using different names and, you know, can get a little bit confusing. This is a useful thing. But what this means in terms of the big picture, I mean, you know, compared to, you know, a slightly sterner line perhaps that we've taken with Russia, whether or not this has the kind of teeth that people want to see given the very long, you know, backstory and extent of Chinese activity over the years and all the benefits they've gained from that, you know?
The problem is, right, when you look at say you want to sanction Russia by targeting its oil and gas sector, you're going to piss off all your European allies, right? That is a fact. Europe needs that energy from Russia, and they're not going to take too kindly to the US getting in the way of that. Similarly with China, you know that if you actually put meaningful sanctions on them, China knows how to play this game. They know how to play dirty. And there are a lot of very large American companies that have critical business interests in China. So that's just one thing I want people to consider when there's this discussion of like, why don't they go harder? That's why they don't go harder, because there'll be consequences if you go harder.
Yeah, I mean, even, you know, some of the more wishy-washy stuff that Australia's been having going on with China has turned into some pretty dirty play, you know, with some of your industries and exports. So, yeah, they absolutely do understand how to play that game. And I think, you know, when you look at the size of the Chinese economy and how reliant we are on, you know, all of the things there, yes, you know, it is a real complicated set of geopolitics that you have to dance around. But on the other hand, like, China has been pretty audacious. And, you know, I know there's a few people who are saying, well, hey, you know, the US and all of the allies, you know, do many of the same things. And I think that's the, you know, the angle of tying in some of these operators are doing crime in their spare time.
That's not the stuff that the United States is complaining about. The US and its allies, they're not complaining about collection. You know, they're complaining about just rampant exploitation of exchange boxes willy-nilly and crime stuff. And like, they're complaining about the stuff that they should complain about. It seems pretty reasonable to me.
Yeah, like you shell a couple of government agencies, Office 365, that's totally fine. 100,000 exchange boxes, okay, perhaps that is across a little bit of a line, apparently.
Mm. Hey, one thing I'd point out too is that China's had very limited success in punishing Australia. You know, we were all pretty concerned down here that they were going to destroy some of our export industries, but ultimately those goods just found other markets. It's like barley, right? It was one of the first things they hit. They put huge tariffs on Australian barley. And as a result, you know, Chinese importers of barley bought from other markets, and then there was a shortfall in those markets, and we just sold to them. I mean, that's the advantage of being a commodities economy, I guess, right? But, you know, another thing too is, as a part of this whole thing, the Chinese embassy in Canberra is apoplectic. They've gone completely apeshit over this.
Well, that's good, I guess. You know, having the finger pointed at them, you know, that's, you know, being able to maintain face is real important. And there's certainly some pretty clear messages that, you know, that they have been seen and are being pointed out right now. So we have to see whether that results in any change in you know, how they approach things. I don't know about that.
Now, for some more thoughts on this, I actually asked Katie Nichols, who is the director of Intel at Red Canary, to give us her take on this whole thing. And this is what Katie had to say.
One of the things I think it's important for this community to remember is that this series of documents and actions against China is really meant to be strategic messaging by the U.S. government and the Biden administration and its allies. This isn't really meant to be some tactical release of information that's useful for network defenders right now. Reading through that presidential statement and the various documents, you can tell this is really the Biden administration saying, China, your behavior in cyberspace is unacceptable. It's a naming and shaming. The details in the indictment, for example, clearly are meant to send a message to China that the U.S. government and its allies know what they are up to, and they have known what they've been up to in cyberspace for years and years. It remains to be seen how effective this messaging will be. And one thing that a lot of policy wonks are rightly pointing out is that this kind of naming and shaming likely isn't going to be sufficient to deter China from doing this in the future. Likely other follow-on actions like economic sanctions would be needed to really change their behavior. One other thing that's notable about this particular action is how broad of an international coalition was involved. Often the U.S. government will issue indictments. That's not really new, but this was really a global action. NATO got in on this, the U.K., the EU, Australia, Japan. And so I think that's important because the more countries that are involved, perhaps the more compelled China will be to change their behavior. At the tactical level, really important to understand that this series of documents in the indictment were really a grab bag of information about different Chinese actors. So in the presidential statement, they mentioned attribution to China for the exchange exploitation activity. That was really already known. Microsoft already attributed that activity to the group known as Hafnium, which was suspected Chinese state-sponsored. So Hafnium was one of the groups involved. Then the indictment was on a group known as APT-40. Then separately, NCSC mentioned APT-31. A different group was in there. And then in that presidential statement, there was actually information about some ransomware operators that seems like they were moonlighting, not operating at the request of the Chinese government. And so that's at least four different clusters or groups of actors here. Can be kind of confusing from a defender perspective to kind of divide those out. So that's one important thing to remember is that there are multiple groups here. And I think what that tells us is that this was really an effort by the U.S. government and allies to say, we know about a lot of activity across many years.
That was Katie Nichols of Red Canary there. Big thanks to her for that. Now we're going to move on to the other big news story of the week. And some organization based in France called Forbidden Stories somehow obtained a list that it claims is 50,000 targets of the Israeli, iPhone malware maker NSO group. They worked with a whole bunch of media outlets. And of course, they did this big coordinated splash. Some of the coverage is quite interesting, talking about dissidents and, journalists and all sorts of people who've apparently been impacted by the so-called Pegasus malware. But I got to say, this whole thing just doesn't feel quite right to me. We've seen some extremely strident denials from NSO. Not that you can put too much faith in them, But one thing that strikes you about all the coverage when you read it is no one really talks about the provenance or origin of this list of numbers. And that, frankly, isn't good enough, I don't think.
Yeah, this is really an interesting story. And reading through the coverage, it certainly comes across as super compelling. And some of the publications and like the coordination between media organizations and researchers and Amnesty and so on has been really, you know, really good, right? There's some really good quality work. But to my mind, there's kind of three parts to the story, right? There is this list of targeting, you know, based on provenance, you know, that we don't know. There is a bunch of analysis of Pegasus infrastructure, building on a bunch of, you know, high quality work that's come out of Citizen Lab over the years and other organizations that have investigated NSO's delivery infrastructure. And then there's forensics on a number of compromised iPhones. And those latter two seem pretty solid. Like you read through, Amnesty's published a whole bunch of detail about how they've done forensics on the phones and how they've got artifacts of Pegasus malware on those phones, and they've tied that back to previous work from other, you know, researchers, had that reviewed. Like, that all looks really solid. They actually produced a tool that can look at iPhone backups and check for indicators of compromise for this, you know, kind of Pegasus family of you know, attack tools and malware. And then, you know, the network infrastructure side of it, all, you know, a bunch of domains, a bunch of their kind of proxy networks, you know, a bunch of smart fingerprinting work, that also looks really good. And then there's this first part, which is this targeting list. And there's almost no information about where that comes from, even really what it means. And that's where most of NSO's denials have focused, right, is that this is just, you know, a list of numbers. Some of them can't be targeted by Pegasus, you know, because they're in the US, for example. And so, yeah, that part of the story is way less transparent than the rest of it. And that's the thing that stood out for me reading the coverage.
Yeah, and their denials are sort of along the lines of, hey, we've only got like 45 customers, and of them, they only target 100 people a year. You know, this doesn't really make any sense to us. And I mean, I hate to say it, but I just think there's more to this story than what's being reported, you know, and I don't know what that more is. I've got no idea, but there's more going on here. I mean, NSO can be bad actors, and some of this reporting can also be incorrect. It's just, I feel like what's going on here is that because NSO are the publicly identified boogeyman, every time we see something bad, we kind of ascribe it to them. It's almost like they're the Loch Ness Monster and they killed JFK, kind of rolled into one. Do you know what I mean? Whereas this is a very big space. I also wonder about some of the forensics. I mean, you know, everyone knows I'm not an expert in forensics and whatnot. But sometimes you wonder, hey, is there some sort of shared framework that some of these companies use to develop the implant side of this? And they focus their efforts on the exploitation side. How do we know that these forensic artifacts aren't actually shared between different spyware makers, right? So I just think there's a lot we don't know here. And I would feel a lot more comfortable if we had better information about this list. Because as you say, there's a lot of really compelling stuff here when it comes to phase two and three. But the list is what gives us the scale, right? You with me?
Yeah, I am. Because I mean, all of the headlines are, you know, this world leader or this family member of, you know, of an opposition person or journalist or whatever. Like that, the human aspect of this is really where the focus is. And a lot of the quite good reporting has been, you know, on that human side of it. And when you look at the forensics on the devices, right, they've got something like, what, 60-something devices Amnesty looked at, of which they've found signs of Pegasus on 30-something. It's biased towards iPhones because the forensic artifacts are stronger on that platform than on Android. But when you've got a targeting list of 50,000, to then draw the conclusion that that implies some, you know, that all of those people were also targeted, that connection is a little bit flimsy. And there's been a couple of suggestions. I think like in the Guardian story, there was some mention of this phone set of numbers coming from an HLR lookup, and we saw NSO mention the same thing in one of their arguments.
No, I've seen this thing pop up, and I've got no idea what a HLR lookup is, so I'm guessing half the audience doesn't either. Can you explain that to us?
So the HLR is the home location register, which is sort of like a directory service for a mobile phone number to say which mobile carrier is responsible for it, where it's being served. If you want to send a message, make a phone call, one of the first steps is you query the HLR for that carrier to find out where to go and kind of direct that message or call setup process. And so I guess the suggestion here is that as part of, you know, sending an attack using the Pegasus framework to a target, there is a step where you do an HLR lookup to figure out which network it's in. Presumably then that's where they would also apply checks to kind of restrict who could be targeted. There was some mention of like a number of public HLR lookup services. I mean, this is a thing you could just go and do or pay for access to or do yourself if you're on the mobile network. So the suggestion, I guess, there is that someone either works at an HLR lookup place or shelled it and stole logs or whatever else. And maybe those were tied to, you know, an API key that's related to NSO.
Or an IP.
Or an IP, or, you know, maybe there's some way of attributing, you know, use of an HLR lookup server somewhere on the internet to users of NSO or somebody else's thing, and that's the kind of time. But we just haven't seen any data other than there exists a list of numbers. Some of the people on that list have been targeted by Pegasus malware, according to device forensics and network forensics, and that's kind of about where we're at. There's also, I mean, some of the network evidence, some of the network artifacts are where Pegasus has been delivered through, you know, network redirection, you know, implying that that was done with the cooperation of a mobile carrier, which, you know, in a government situation where they bought the service and have deployed it into their local mobile operator, that would make sense. And so that also, I guess, can provide, you know, some way of tying all these things together, the numbers. Like if you have, they've got logs, for example, of some of these redirections occurring. So, yeah, there's a few bits and pieces there, but we just don't know enough about this list of numbers to really conclude, you know, what it means to be on that list or who's on that list or where it came from or anything like that yet, which is, yeah, that's difficult.
Yeah, it is. And again, I mean, I'm not saying this in defense of NSO, right? Like I could give a shit about NSO's public standing, but I guess I'm just cautious with this one because this is an industry that's a lot bigger than people realize, right? Yes. And just because you've got one publicly visible boogeyman doesn't mean there aren't other boogie people out there. And those boogie persons could be using shared components, I guess, is what I'm getting at. Do you think that's at all plausible?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, building a good quality implant that can survive and be deployed and has all the features you want, there's no reason that you couldn't buy that from some other vendor or, you know, that there are other components as a service. Like we've seen this kind of as a service model or this kind of, you know, very specialized, you know, sub companies selling services to other in the crime world. You know, it's not unreasonable that you would do that in the defense and intelligence and spooky world as well.
Well, I mean, the one thing that I've believed NSO on is that they can't target plus one phone numbers because, you know, the reason I believe it is because they just don't need the grief and also because we haven't seen cases of, you know, Pegasus allegedly turning up on US-based phones with plus one phone numbers, right? There's a few examples in the stories here of US officials overseas. The really funny one was in one of the newspapers, I think it was Washington Post, where they were talking about how, oh no, an American official involved in the nuclear deal negotiations with Iran got his phone owned. And I'm like, if that's not a example of appropriate collection, I don't know what is. I don't know why you're highlighting that one because oh no, he's American. But you know, that was one case where I believed NSO and that, you know, further clouded the whole Bezos thing because he was on a plus one number. But anyway, as I say, I just think hopefully this shakes out more reporting and more facts and we can actually get a handle on the extent to which this activity is attributable to NSO versus to other bad actors, because there are plenty.
Yeah, exactly right. This is a much bigger industry than people realize, and you know anything that increases the visibility of it is probably useful. And yeah, it's a you know every little bit does add up to the bigger picture story, and you know there's just so much uncertainty and so much we don't know, and so much stuff that happens in you know kind of in the shadows and in places that aren't reported. That it is very hard to draw the right conclusions the first time, you know. And as we get further into it, obviously we'll get a bit better at that. But yeah, there's certainly some interesting data points in here for future research. I mean, there was one bit I saw on the US targeting angle where like there was someone who had a Belgian phone, but they went to the US and the Pegasus stopped working whilst they were in the US and then started up again when they went back home or something like that. So, you know, there's some interesting data in there.
Yeah, there sure is. And look, this isn't to say that this reporting is inaccurate. For all we know, it's perfectly 100% accurate. It's just my spidey sense just has me going a little bit...
Yeah, exactly. Like there's definitely stuff we don't know about here and, you know, it's hard to draw... you know, exactly the right conclusions from what we've seen so far.
Now let's talk about Candiru, which is apparently another Israeli firm that is a so-called hack for hire company. Citizen Lab and Microsoft have put out some info here, Adam.
Yeah, this looks at a number of zero-day bugs and other pieces of implant malware deployed by a number of governments. I think a couple of governments we've seen attributed so far from this commercial vendor. And you know, we've talked a bit on the show about some of the other you know commercial vendors. We talked, I think, a while ago. Google Tag put out a blog post saying, "Hey, we've got some zero-day in Chrome and Safari and Internet Explorer that we attribute to a commercial company," but they didn't say who. It now turns out that this is who they were talking about.
Yeah, Yeah, and you got to wonder too, if headlines like this continue and if, you know, exploits like this keep being used irresponsibly, it seems to be a big industry in Israel, and you got to wonder at what point countries start putting out nasty grams referring to Israel, right? Like, at what point does this become a problem for Israel? I do wonder that.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a good question, especially, you know, with some of the NSO stuff where we saw, you know, it's specifically other countries in the Gulf where the political relationships and the commercial relationships perhaps aren't exactly as everybody expects. You know, here, you know, we're seeing, you know, Israeli bugs being used, you know, to target Armenians. I don't know what the relationship between Israel and Armenia is like. But yeah, you could certainly imagine, you know, if we saw this being deployed in, you know, some other countries, you know, bugs that are directly attributable to Israeli vendors being deployed, you know, in Australia or New Zealand, for example, what that would mean in terms of a political relationship. You could imagine it eventually becoming an issue.
Yeah, it could get a little awks, that's for sure. I think it could even get a little bit awkward, even if you're not talking about citizens or allies. It's just like, you know, if there's still that indiscriminate targeting of people who are like enemies of shitty states, like, I think that can still turn into an issue, but time will tell. And look, moving on, and speaking of this, you know, you just alluded to the fact that some bugs were used against Armenians. Google Tag put out this excellent blog post talking about a whole bunch of activity, and some of it was looking at some ODAs being used against Armenian targets. There's been a bunch of news articles spun out of the Tag research. That research, of course, comes to us from Maddie Stone and Clement Lassine. So, yeah, let's talk through these ones, Adam. I mean, again, Armenians targeted with a swag of ODAs. No real surprises there, given they were recently in a war.
Well, yeah, exactly. So some of these bugs, I mean, Google obviously tracks Zerida that they've seen being used in the wild, and the quality of information available to them to do that is pretty unique. Like, they have a great perspective, being both a browser vendor and a really good kind of security research crew. But yeah, they put together a write-up of a couple of commercial Chrome bugs from Kandaroo that they've seen being used. The same bug also impacted Safari, which they passed across to Apple, although there didn't appear to be any targeting of Safari users. There was also a really interesting bug where rather than escape the browser sandbox, they would actually run the exploit code, you know, inside the browser sandbox, turn off same origin policy, and then steal cookies for other services that the browser was logged into. In this case, you know, Microsoft Cloud Services and that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, why take over the endpoint when you just want the webmail, right?
Well, exactly right. And we've seen some researchers talking about this kind of avenue, because the browser is the whole operating system these days, and the rest is just kind of, you know, support plumbing for that. Then, yeah, why bother escaping the sandbox if you could just nick the cookies and pass them off? And I think that particular part was attributed to SVR or one of the other Russian state organizations. But yeah, really smart targeting technique, rather than, you know, waste a sandbox escape if you don't need to.
Well, I think that's why Google spent so much time looking at per tab isolation, right? In Chrome is for exactly that reason. Meanwhile, Google's patched another Chrome O-Day. It's the 8th for 2021, so that's just a sign of the times. Now, I think it was last week or the week before, we mentioned that there was this, or maybe even a few weeks ago, we mentioned that there was this really silly little bug in iPhones where if you set a funny SSID and got it to connect to that over its Wi-Fi, it would, you know, brick the phone basically, or just brick the Wi-Fi function. And, you know, at the time we were like, well, at least it's not exploitable. About that.
Some researchers from ZecOps turned out, yes, they could leverage this to turn it into code execution via some, I mean, you know, it's format string bugs have obviously, you know, had plenty of success as an exploitation primitive in the past. But yeah, through some manner of interaction with like the crash pattern, crash dumper or something, they managed to turn that into use after free in code exec, which, you know, kudos to pulling that thread and making it work. But oh dear, yeah, that's not great. Being, you know, nearby a wireless network and getting yourself shelled, not good.
Now, look, we've just spent the front half of this show talking about, you know, O-Day exchange exploitation, about full, intricate, detailed end-to-end iOS exploit chains and subsequent implants. We're talking about browser O-Day, and these are really fall into the category of
internet weapon.
Okay. But now we're going to talk about the deadliest internet weapon. Adam, you know, this is being used by, you know, huge publications and newspapers around the world have been talking about this deadly cyber weapon in the case of the Kaseya ransomware attacks. You know, a lot has been made of the fact that ransomware crews, Adam, they're using O-Day now. They're using O-Day. Now, people would have heard me in recent programs saying, look, not all O-Day is created equal, and maybe we shouldn't conflate the trash O'Day that ransomware crews are using versus actual sort of government level O'Days that are used for things like surveillance. We now have some details on the bug that was used in this Kaseya ransomware attack. Adam, drumroll, please. Will you please tell us about this deadly cyber weapon that should have us all quaking in our boots?
So the piece of code that checked the password being submitted during the login process to Kaseya's software basically had a loop that ended with, if we got through all of the other conditions in the loop, then let's return true. This is fine. The user is all good. And this particular set of the loop would say, is the password wrong? Okay, well, if it is, then fail, and so on and so forth. Had a bunch of checks. It didn't actually check for the password just not being there. Like, if the password was null, then it would just kind of fall off the end of the loop and authenticate you.
It's been a while since we broke out the sad trombone.
Yeah, certainly well deserved here. Yes, this is a great example of some really, really terrible bugs. And I think, you know, lots of old pen testers and old hackers will remember, you know, this kind of bug from, 10, 15 years ago. This is the sort of thing that would happen. But I mean, I guess this code was probably 15 years old, because that's kind of feels about the vintage.
But it's just been making me feel like I'm taking crazy pills, you know, like reading the coverage about, oh no, ransomware crews are using O'Day. You know, there's a big difference between the sort of stuff that NSO group's peddling and, you know, just submitting a null password, mashing a few buttons on the keyboard and getting shells.
Yes, there is a little bit of a difference there. You would certainly hope this Kaseya bug was not worth the, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars or whatever you're going to flog off, you know, a fine iOS exploit chain for. Ah, dear, dear.
But just remember that, policy wonks and fellow journalists, O'Day isn't O'Day, okay? There is some nuance there, actually quite a lot. So that's something to keep in mind.
Although, as we say on the show, sometimes it's not dumb if it works.
That's fine, but let's just, you know, let's just not hold up that sort of thing as an example of, like, ransomware crews moving into dangerous cyber weapon territory. Yeah. Like, oh, God. what have we got here? Some ransomware affecting a cloud provider called CloudStar. This is a managed service provider for a bunch of industry sectors. This report comes to us via Catalin Kimpanu for The Record.
Yeah, this is a cloud service used by a number of, like, real estate services and associated organizations. And yeah, it looks like the cloud service provider got themselves owned, all the data locked up or stolen or whatever else. And yeah, a number of organizations have now found themselves dead in the water because of their service provider just disappearing. And they said that it's a very, very sophisticated attack.
That means it worked.
Succumbed to. Yes, that means it worked.
Apparently, they got the backups too. I saw some discussion of that on Twitter.
Ruh-roh. Well, that's not a great time. They're going to be struggling. But we've seen, you know, this kind of service provider certainly under more pressure to go pay up than perhaps individual end user organizations. You know, much like Kaseya was being pressured to pay for a master key for everybody. You know, I'm sure, you know, anytime you hit a cloud service provider, they're going to really pile on the pressure, and we'll see whether they pay.
Yeah. Now, look, one thing I wanted to discuss this week is last week, listeners would know that, you know, I got on my soapbox and had a bit of a rant about how there's no real product testing for US government purchases, right? Of, like, you know, if you want to buy an F5 or whatever, you don't have to test it. You don't, you know, there's no sort of standard that thing has to meet. And that's maybe a bit of a problem. And I was saying maybe they should have to commit to bug bounty programs and stuff, maybe administered by the government in conjunction with one of the platforms. Since then, you know, we've been really looking into this. And it turns out, first of all, there is such a program for cloud providers, which is, of course, FedRAMP, right? Which everyone hates, but it actually serves a purpose. So, you know, if you want to sell a cloud service to the US government, you need to be able to show stuff like, yeah, we got it pen tested. Now, for products, there is nothing similar, but that is actually changing because of a recent executive order. So what's happening now is NIST is actually working out the details for what organizations will have to do to essentially become approved vendors. I just thought it was worth mentioning that, given it was something we kind of touched on last week. There is actually a little bit of movement here.
Yeah, I mean, this is good to see, and this is good to see moving at a relatively rapid pace. I mean, developing this kind of framework and getting all of the necessary bits in place, you know, is, you know, normally would be a really long process. And seeing this move a bit quicker is, you know, reassuring. NIST have got some guidelines now around, you know, what what is critical software that needs to be kind of assured in ways that haven't been in the past for government use. And they've got some guidelines, for example, for how developers should test their products before they sell them to the US government.
But their definition of critical software too, thumbing through the documents, it's actually pretty good because it's not about critical infrastructure. It's like anything that like is at the network boundary and has any sort of privilege, that's critical, you know? And it's like, you read through it and you're like, okay, someone put some thought into this.
Yeah, certainly that side of it, yeah, having a broad coverage of what's applicable, you know, what it's applicable to is certainly important. And they've also got, you know, aspects of supply chain and making sure that you're able to, you know, kind of ties in with this software bill of materials idea that we've seen kicking around so that this does extend to, you know, open source components and, you know, all the way up into the supply chain, which is just super important. The guidelines for developer testing are also pretty interesting. You know, they've got recommendations about threat modeling, about automated testing and use of heuristics to spot key material and that kind of thing. It doesn't seem to be, on my reading of it, to be requirements for, you know, external security testing, you know, pen testing, code review, that kind of thing, outside of the organization yet, which when we were talking last week, I guess that's what we were really thinking was external validation rather than
developers. I think that's coming actually. I mean, maybe I'm going to have to dive into this more, but I think that might become a criteria.
Yeah, and I certainly hope it gets there. But I mean, this focus so far on what
maybe not for code audits, but just for testing, you know.
Yeah, I mean, having some testing would certainly be. You know, in my opinion, given I'm a tester, seems useful. But no, I mean, having guidelines for developers, you know, to suggest that they use fuzzing, to suggest that they use code coverage-based tools and that they test for previous bug classes, you know, these are all really sensible suggestions. And if this was a minimum baseline standard, then it's pretty comprehensive for that. Although, obviously, there's always more that we can and probably should do.
Yeah. And funnily enough, just like, and this is what I said on Twitter a couple of days ago, that this week's news is just like the perfect narrative arc. Ron Wyden has just been blocked by the GSA, the General Services Administration in the US. He was trying to FOI the details of how on earth Zoom got approved for FedRAMP use like a couple of weeks before that really awful bug showed up in it. You know, I mean, these things can happen, right? Like Zoom, as it turns out, like they've done a pretty good job, especially since the onset of the pandemic, of really making security a bit of a focus. But it just goes to show that, yeah, you can ram stuff through any sort of process like this and give it a tick, and it can still have problems and it can still be rubbish. I mean, this is why last week I was talking about the bounty side. And look, I understand that bounties can be problematic, right? You get a lot of junk reports. You know, you can only do so much with black box testing and stuff, but I still think they should be there for when, say, someone like you, Adam, are doing a test for some bank who's trying to buy a product. You know, you can go look up and see if there's this bounty program, you know, being administered by the US government with one of the platform providers, and you could throw that bug in there as well as in your report, and hey, it gets reported to the vendor and you get some cash, right? So I just think there's some stuff that could be done there as well.
Yeah, I mean, certainly even just making the process of dealing with the vendors more straightforward is one of the great things that bug bounty programs have brought to the party, because I mean, trying to report bugs to vendors is always... It's always worse than actually finding the damn bugs in the first place, you know? But hey, the type of testing and the methodology and approach really does matter, right? I mean, I'm sitting here looking right now at Accelion's FedRAMP certification, right? And we know that when you go look in a slightly different way, then hey, bugs still fall out. So
yeah. And that's, you know, their cloud side as well, which, yes, I think you may have revealed a little bit more than you intended to there, Adam, about some recent work you may have been doing. But anyway... Let's see. The TSA in the United States, not so surprisingly, is tightening up cybersecurity demands of pipeline operators.
Yes, certainly. TSA has been very well known for lots of, you know, security theater and doing things after the fact. So yes, following up ransomware, following up pipeline operators to make sure that they have the necessary things to detect ransomware in their environments probably does. I mean, clearly it's a thing that needs to happen, and good to see some pressure being applied, but does seem a little bit reactive there perhaps.
Now, staying with the U.S. government, and this one's kind of funny because the U.S. State Department is offering a $10 million reward for information about state-sponsored hackers disrupting critical infrastructure. Now, is it just me, or does that seem like a pretty narrow criteria?
That's a very specific tip line right
this
there.
This is Colonel Mustard in the library with the candlestick level of detail, you know, but only if he was bludgeoning, a pipeline.
Yes. So I guess if you're one of the, few hundred people that's working in whatever department that is at a government agency, in China or Russia or wherever else, and you want to dob in one of your colleagues who, stole your stapler or whatever else, then you too could get $10 million. And we do know that the US State Department has an onion site for you to make contact with them, and they will pay you in cryptocurrency. they're really lining it all up for you there. If you'd like to dob in your colleagues, make a bit of cash, go to the Black Sea and party it up with everybody else, then you know what to do.
Now, ironically enough, that cryptocurrency could wind up, you could have some trouble there, because the US government, other parts of the US government, Treasury, they're following through by the looks of things on their plan to more tightly regulate cryptocurrency under the guise of disrupting the ransomware ecosystem. I mean, every commentator who's been paying attention over the last couple of months knew this was coming.
Yeah, certainly not a big surprise. I mean, the usual sorts of things that, have been telegraphed so far of more requirements on currency exchanges, more attempts to deal with the know-your-customer sort of stuff, things to crack down on other ways that cryptocurrency has been abused. And, there's lots of avenues that the US government's been pushing, from a tax side, from a fraud, from a, paying ransom sort of side of things to pull it together. But it is just funny seeing that, juxtaposition of one arm of the government offering to pay people in cryptocurrency for their safety, and then the other half trying to track them down so that you can't.
Yeah, pretty much. We got Microsoft, a story here, another one from Catalan. Microsoft has apparently taken control of 17 domains used by a West African BEC gang. The only depressing thing about this is that it's actually news, like nuking seven. I mean, how many domains would there be doing this sort of stuff? I'll tell you, it's more than 17.
But hey, it's funny in the way that, business email compromise seems such a sort of quaint relic of older times now.
Oh, no, comparison. Man. That is like one of the most active crime types. It is still causing all sorts of drama out there. I mean, if anything, it doesn't get enough attention.
Yeah, I guess that's what I mean. Like, everyone's so focused on ransomware and zero day lately, and we do forget about the workaday honest grift of being a BEC scammer,
which is responsible probably for more financial harm than ransomware, which is the crazy thing. Look, let's not talk about this one, but I just want to mention it. It's linked to in this week's show notes. It's a report from Joe Cox. He's been doing some great work in the data privacy space lately, and he's looking at this entire industry that exists that de-anonymizes people. You buy these anonymized data sets, and he's like, well, there are all these brokers who just say, oh, we can totally match that to PII, which is legally questionable, but it's certainly an industry that exists. We've got another one from Catalan here, where Instagram is rolling out new tools to help people better secure their accounts so that they can recover them, which people would have heard me banging on about this for ages. Instagram recovery flows are just such a wild, hot mess, Adam.
Yeah, they've introduced a new process for dealing with account compromise where it'll prompt you for more things and kind of walk you through the process of securing your account, which, as you say, like the current approach is a little bit of a mess. So good to see them improving it. I imagine they'll roll it out gradually, given the size of the user base and that kind of thing. So you may not see it immediately on your hacked account. I don't know.
I mean, I've been behind the scenes on a couple of these, like one account takeover that abused the trademark protection process. So someone registered a trademark in someone else's name, and it was just pending, but they were able to use that paperwork, which was against Instagram's policies, but they were able to use it anyway to seize the account and then take over the brand. So that was one. There's another one. A guy was just DMing me the other day. The account, if anyone from Facebook's listening and wants to sort this one out, the account is called Daniel Castro Photo. Some photographer, right? Had a decent following. It's part of his business. I think he got fished, and now the person's trying to sell him the account back for $300 or something. But it's just... And I've seen screen caps where he was told, click here if the phone number change on your account wasn't you. You go through these processes and they do nothing. Like, that's how bad Instagram takeovers have gone. It's just terrible. Anyway, I'm ranty today. Have you noticed?
Yeah.
Okay, we've got a report here from the Daily Swig written up by Adam Bannister. This one's quite funny. This is a write-up of research from the Twitter user who calls themselves A Bad Idea, OX A Bad Idea, on Twitter. They looked at the code quality generated by GitHub's new machine learning code generator called Copilot and discovered that it writes hideously insecure code. And obviously this is because it's been trained on dog shit.
Yes, exactly. Like, I mean, this is how the machine learning works. If you train the machine on, you know, the combined wisdom of Stack Overflow and GitHub, then you get something which generates code of that style. I'm sure there's plenty of high quality code out there, but
there's also a lot of not so. Yeah. I think someone on Twitter said to me that it basically is just automated the cut and paste from Stack Overflow. Yes, approach, right?
Exactly. Like, smoothed out that whole developer workflow. But yeah, there's a bunch of examples here of it generating, you know, code that has buffer overflows in it, or code that doesn't, you know, handle edge cases properly, or, you know, code that has even in this case, the researcher who was playing with it missed some bugs that had been introduced by that were then subsequently pointed out by somebody else on Twitter. So yeah, really good example of you know, not being able to rely on these tools. And, you know, developers who work in an IDE that's popping up documentation and suggestions and things, often they're quite used to that being of a reasonable standard, you know, that automated help. And they may not necessarily understand that this has just been generated by ML from a corpus of you know, code written by randoms.
Yep. So, monkey see, monkey do is the problem with this sort of machine learning, right? Yeah. So congratulations to Bad Idea. She did a terrific job there. Now, Adam, we've got some research to talk through. First off, let's start with this thing that's being reported again by the Daily Swig by Jessica Howarth. Apparently, there was a RCE vuln in Cloudflare's CDN.
Yeah, this one is actually really bad. So this was a bug reported by a researcher that essentially this CDN would cache JavaScript libraries, and there was a process by which the cache, like Cloudflare's cache engines, would refresh the JavaScript dependencies. And so if you got it to cache a library that it didn't know about or that you controlled, you could then eventually lead to like path traversal and command execution. So you could path traversal to overwrite, like you're refreshing the cache, and then overwrite the code that was actually running to do this regeneration process. So the net result was code exec in Cloudflare's CDN, with then, of course, the ability to go and rewrite code that's being served to people coming out of it. And this is something like 12% of the internet. So that's pretty bad.
Yeah.
And someone found this and reported it by their bug bounty, which, I mean, I hope they got a whole, I don't know how much money they got out of Cloudflare for that, but that seems really bad.
Now, moving on, last week we were talking about those ForgeRock bugs, and you mentioned something to the effect of, well, that's long abandoned, you know, long abandoned project, hasn't been touched in 10 years sort of thing. A listener tweeted at me to let us know that it actually did get some love about a year ago, and a lot of the old Sun cruft has actually been stripped out of it. Just thought it's worth mentioning.
Yes, yeah. I was certainly referring to the very old bits of very old Sun infrastructure that was in there. So if they've ripped that out recently, then that was a smart move. Good plan.
Excellent. And now it's time to wrap up the show, Adam, with our skateboarding dog. I don't even know where to begin with this, but this is very 90s. This is very 90s and affecting Win10. This is crazy. I'm going to just say it. A user can actually read the SAM file on Win10 under plenty of default configurations in this year of our Lord 2021.
I know, right? I mean, if you shell some like AIX or HPUX box from the 80s and you can, you know, read the Unix password file and it's still got the hashes in it because it predates shadowing, then that would be expected. The idea that you could do the same thing on a Windows box in the year 2021 AD is a little bit nuts.
This is how we got free internet access in the 90s.
It's how many crimes were done. But yeah, at some point, Microsoft, I think maybe going back to even a year or two ago, at some point they must have been, I don't know what they were doing, but they've shipped an update that makes the SAM file readable by built-in users. So that's like everybody who's a local user on the machine. And then you can't read it because of locking, but you can read it out of the volume shadow copy service as a regular user. And there's a few other nuances, like obviously volume shadowing has to be turned on to do that. And that is the case if you've ever had a system restore point created, I think. Anyway, net result is, a regular user can just read the SAM file, which is straight up Privisk on client Windows. Doesn't affect Windows servers. It's only Windows 10 after, I think, 1909 update or something like that. But this is real boneheaded.
It is.
And I don't know what Microsoft were,
Microsoft making big sort of strategic mistakes and dumb bugs and botched patches. And like, I got to admit to feeling, you know, it's like putting on a favorite old t-shirt or something, you know, it's I'm kind of glad they're bad again. It feels right because they went through a good phase. You know, they actually, I mean, you know, they went through an okay
it's
phase.
Relative. Compared to IE6 and ActiveX and, Office 95.
There was a moment there where hating Microsoft was kind of uncool, you know, and I'm just glad we're back to that tradition.
Yeah.
It's about tradition.
It is. It's certainly very, very familiar. It's concerning, of course, given their importance in the ecosystem. It's even potentially even bigger than it ever was.
Just let it burn, Adam. Just let it burn.
But, there's plenty of people in InfoSec Twitter saying, hey, you know, Microsoft spending all their time selling E5 licenses and not enough time doing basic security like setting the read bit, on the SAM file.
Because there was a while a few years ago where they started botching patches and missing cycles and stuff, and you thought, okay, they got some resource constraints in the part of Microsoft that does that. Let's not, kick the crap out of them for that. But it just seems like things haven't really improved there. And meanwhile, they're out there saying security is a $10 billion revenue center for us. Yeah. Woo, to the moon. Yeah. And you just sort of think, you're a bunch of aren't you? And that's not to take anything away. There's a lot of very good people at Microsoft fighting the good fight, but they deserve better from management.
They do, right? And you certainly get a picture when you talk to some of the people who've been through Microsoft that, there are absolutely pockets of really excellent competence and really motivated, driven people there that are really doing a good job. And then, there's a bunch of structural aspects and structural issues in that organization.
And politics.
And so much politics. And So, and we are all so dependent on them getting everything right all the time, and...
Nationalize Microsoft. I'm kidding. But that's the sort of thing the kids say these days, isn't it?
It's...
Because that's one thing that'll really improve an enterprise. Get the government to run it, How could you? It's probably the only way you could make it worse, let's be honest.
Oh, dear.
All right, well, Adam, that's actually it for this week's news. What a great week for news. Like, what a absolutely fantastic grab bag of stuff we got to talk about this week. It was a real pleasure to chat to you, and we'll do it all again next week. Thanks again.
All right, cheers, Pat. Talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. Now I'm about to do something that I rarely, rarely do on this show and just give a shameless plug to some software. Rulof Temming is the creator of Multigo, the OSINT analysis tool, and for the last few years he's been working on his next big thing, which is called Vortimo. And finally, it is out. It's released and it's ready for general use. I did play around with an earlier version of Vortimo, and I just think it's the sort of thing that a lot of the audience is going to want to use, going to want to check out. So I asked Rulof to send in some audio explaining what Vortimo actually is, and here's what he told me.
So Vortimo is made for online investigators, the whole OSINT business. So you're looking at journalists, incident response, anyone that's chasing bad people on the internet. But I can actually totally see how it can be used by lawyers or academics or, anyone that actually uses a browser to research any kind of topic. Vortimo is a software that augments your browsing experience by kind of allowing you to tag elements. And with elements, we mean text or images or pages. And that happens right inside of your browser. So you can highlight those things and say these things are important to you. And then as you go to other pages, the software would tell you that those tags are seen on the pages that you're on at the moment. It also has its own kind of UI where you can have different views on the pages that you've browsed to. So you can firstly see it as making this browser of yours super capable. But there's also, like I said, a UI where you view the data that you've collected, obviously, completely offline. So even if the pages are removed or changed or so, all that data stays on your local drive, nothing in the cloud, any of those kind of things. We've been working on this for way too long, to be honest. I have serious letting go issues with the software. So it's been 2.5 years. I guess the reason why it took so long is that the problem is actually a lot more slippery than you can even start to anticipate. Mostly because from the start, I've set these crazy design parameters that were really hard to achieve. And those were like making it non-intrusive to the browsing experience, capturing all sites. I mean, how do you even test like all sites? Capturing all of those sites all of the time and running all of that stuff locally without burning up the computer or disk space. So I think it's tough. Those were pretty tough parameters, but I think we managed to find a nice compromise. I kind of hope we did.
Rule of Temming there. And yeah, you can check out Vortimo at vortimo.com. There is a free version, so you can play around with it. And yeah, I mean, it's just of interest to so many people. I even know a lot of journalists listen to this show, so I think they should check it out too. And just so you know, this was not a sponsored announcement or anything like that. I just think it's cool stuff. And, you know, Rulof is just a super smart guy, so you should pay attention to his work. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now. And this week's show is brought to you by Signal Sciences. But instead of talking to them in this slot, we're chatting with one of their customers. JJ Arger is the CISO of Compass, and he is our guest. Today, Compass is an American real estate website, which is aiming to be basically a one-stop shop for property listings and transactions. And as a result, their dev operation is actually fairly huge. JJ tells me they have something like 1,000-ish developers. Now, he is a very, very happy Signal Sciences customer, but we don't just talk about Signal Sciences in this interview, but obviously it features pretty heavily. I'll drop you in here where JJ explains that, rolling out a decent WAF or using a decent WAF is pretty much his first step when deploying new stuff or when he's trying to manage an M&A. So here is JJ Arger.
So, the first thing I typically do is just get a WAF up deployed, so that I know I have visibility into my APIs, my endpoint, all the application telemetry that's coming in and going out. What are my clients? What are my consumers actually using to make better decisions? I need data. I need information to then generate high fidelity alerts, and then to get into a place where I could start actually blocking and be in prevention mode. And that's the goal. I want to be to prevention as quick as possible, and being able to iterate as fast as possible from prevention. So typically I always just go to the kind of the well, and these are products that have always followed me around, but it's been Signal Sciences has been a great kind of for M&As. And as I go into different shops when I was at WeWork, Compass, Vimeo, this tool has been able to kind of allow me to set it up, allow me to take a big breath as I'm trying to wrap my hands around the organization and look at, how do I start pivoting? What is the actual endpoint that is being targeted more, right? All right, let me start building out more detective preventative controls, or just let SigSci do its thing with attack-driven prevention, because I know I could at least sleep at night around my endpoints. But I then need to make sure that if the tool of choice that I am picking and I'm deploying isn't agnostic or have enough extensibility and it's rigid and it only runs on Windows IIS, and that's the only HTTP service it could use, I'm shit out the way. There's nothing I could do. The program is bonked if we are abort, if we're at that point. But that's where like picking a tool, going back to the basics, like what is an HTTP service? Great. As long as I could secure that and there's a gateway for all my endpoints and all my APIs are being published using Zookeeper or some other HA proxy service, and I have asset management around it, great. Now I have full, what I believe is full coverage and better visibility with the ability to actually go into prevention. Now I'm not trying to chase or pick a product that only focuses on one particular niche of a service of, no, it will help support your JSON blobs. Great, but I have XML here. I have Thrift over here. What are we doing?
So I guess the point is, if it is capable of receiving a GET or POST request, you want that being inspected at some point somewhere.
Yeah, I need to secure it, right? Regardless of the technology or where the organization goes, the idea is I need to enable our organization. That goes back to how I select and why I decide on orchestration or automation to really enable the business. It's less about if it's a getter, put what is the business logic in it? Let's build out the process and great, we're up and running. But too often folks are just looking at, all right, here's a get to a SQL. Great, block that. But what is the actual behavior, right? How do you actually double click into it to generate a better, you know, context and higher fidelity information to make a better decision? And I think we're often too strapped with resources or too strapped with debt of tool choices that doesn't alleviate or allow us to be scalable, be modular, be transparent with the program, because we're just kind of in the scrap fight of I need to breathe.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned sort of asset discovery and, you know, automation and orchestration in the same, you know, little chunk there, because those two things are kind of linked, aren't they? Because if you've got your orchestration and automation ducks in a row, then, you know, as part of that process, you understand what's being spun up and what's not. Now, of course, there's always going to be someone doing something outside of the process, and that's where your asset discovery comes in. But usually if you've created good automation processes, it makes a lot of the asset discovery stuff more about catching edge cases than trying to herd cats, right?
Yeah, because if you have all your cats going through the same CI/CD, the same infrastructure, that then it makes your life easier, right? To deploy a change, it's now scalable and it gets on every single PR and every single new endpoint that gets spun up, as long as they're going through the repeatable processes. And then my focus is, to your point, is just on the edge cases, chasing those down, really spending the cycles where it's more meaningful. And those are the edge cases where you see companies get popped, right? Those are the edge cases.
So that's my next question, is how are you actually chasing them down, right? Because I understand that, you know, having a repeatable process, and, you know, Signal Sciences, we're a big fan on this show because they were people who actually took WAFs and made them kind of usable, right? Very funny too, because I often tease the founders about, you know, they didn't call it a WAF when they first launched it, and then all of a sudden it morphed into a next generation WAF, much to their face palming, right? But it is. I mean, it's a good WAF that you can deploy on multiple technologies in multiple different ways, right? And you get some sort of uniformity. It does some pretty sensible blocking. So I understand why you're a fan of it. But I'm interested, when someone in your org, a team in your org, goes outside your normal processes and does something, I will say it, does something dumb, what are your tools and processes for catching that? Because you don't really know what it is, what the dumb thing is before someone does it, it's kind of hard, isn't it, to build a program to catch unknown unknowns?
Yeah, so the unknowns unknowns are just looking for the creepy crawlies, as my CTO likes to say. You know, he really likes the our red team and kind of pen testing conversations, because it finds the unknown unknowns, right? You don't know about them until they become known, and then they're no longer unknown unknowns.
They're known unknowns.
But yes. So with that, it's partly just making sure, you know, asset management, and even if you're an AWS shop, right, having just billing and payments and process asset tagging, right? Because you could actually be in your organization and within your AWS instance, and it could be a known unknown asset within your known space or your known pool. And so those are just some of the things that we're really pushing.
That's really interesting that you say that. So you're saying you can catch it through billing discrepancies.
Yeah.
You know, have you read The Cuckoo's Egg?
No, that's actually Andrew Peterson, CEO of ZigSci, has told me to read that. It is on my list behind me.
Well, it's really funny because the whole thing starts with essentially a billing discrepancy on a big Unix box, which makes the guy curious, right? And then it leads down this big rabbit hole. But that's why I found it really interesting that you're saying that, you know, you can kind of use, because obviously these cloud companies, man, they've put a lot of work into making sure they bill you for every cent that you've used. So, I mean, using that tech that they've built to your advantage, can you give me an example of where, of how you might use a billing, you know, how you might actually detect a billing discrepancy? Because that might be hard.
So, yeah, well, I mean, we're keeping track of like all the resources that are being spun up and spun down. And so when we're using a tool called YotaScale that the tech infrastructure team brought in, but we're now just building on top of that. And that goes back to like the orchestration and automation discussion about that, you know, basic. They need to solve a basic billing problem, right? What team is spinning up what resources and how much in what region? And so now we're actually using that information on top of CloudTrail and all the plethora that these cloud providers will give you to make decisions about what the business deems normal, right? So let's actually isolate all the non-regions that are being used. So if we see an instance spin up in any region, kill it, shoot in the head. That's an asset that should never exist. Yeah. Right. So the people that are going rogue.
So you've actually got some seatbelts there in case people start spinning stuff up outside of what's allowable in your way. Yeah,
because that means they're not, you know, are they going to be able to connect to our VPC? Are they going to be able to connect to our tried and true backend infrastructure, right? And then you have even as simple as AWS asset tagging, right? If an instance is not tagged with a particular team or in particular product, you know, what environment you belong in, know it, we're going to spin it down, right? Mm. And then we could start kind of, you know, it reduces company costs so everyone's happy. And so the cost is just a discussion of risk as well. And so at the end of the day, we're reducing risk in multiple ways, financial waste, as well as security risk of our landscape increasing, right? Our attack surface increasing because there's unknown assets that might be sitting there, right? Looking at security groups, looking at, you know, what is publicly available. Those are all things that, you know, has been commoditized, right? Of looking at what is a security group. The question is now, do you know what that security group actually does? That's the million-dollar question. When you respond to an alert, do you have enough context of that security group is now an any? What is the host that's actually attached to it? What is the business? What is the application actually running on it? And then security is kind of caught with their, you know, in a little bit of a rock and a hard place where whatever decision they make is going to impact something. What is the actual impact? You know, do they have enough context and feel confident or empowered by the business to shut it off? Or do they need to chase everyone around because they're so scared that they're going to be looked at as the security disabler, right? As a security blocker. And so luckily, you know, we've taken that approach where, you know, from our CTO, CEO down, it's been, if you don't know about it, you're more empowered to make the decision. And so we never feel kind of concerned or there's a culture that security is the blocker where we're making kind of these decisions and we're using automation and orchestration for, you know, operational excellence, for better asset tagging, for better insight to our resource consumption to also drive security controls. And so that's where it's less about me in bringing in, hey, these are the new security controls that we're leveraging, which is leveraging the already existing controls and best practices of multiple teams to kind of empower the security, you know, controls and empower the security testing. Like even for us, when we make a decision on, you know, we'll use Signal Sciences again, you know, we were, when I first got here, leveraging Nginx, we moved to HA proxy. Great, no problem. All right, I have two M&As that are coming in. How do we get security coverage there, right? What is the process? If I can't just make it as extensible and as easy for a internal product that wants to spin out or for an M&A that wants to come spin in and use our technology, I'm not making the right decision to put our program and our company in the best place to kind of scale and automate.
I'm curious here too, since the Fastly acquisition, have you found it useful? I mean, because I'm not sure and don't think that saying no is a bad answer here. Mm. Have you found it useful that now Signal Sciences is kind of baked into that network edge post-acquisition? Because it sounds like what you're doing is you're just pasting it in everywhere anyway, so wouldn't have made much difference in your circumstance.
Yeah, so it doesn't make as much just impact to me. Rolling, I guess, all the way back to how I started my security career, I worked at Edgecast Networks. And when we rolled out a WAF there, it was through ModSec, and we included inside of our Flight E4 instance. And so we were in line and being able to provide security controls for our customers.
Yeah, but the ModSec issue is that, like, painful, you know, right? Just painful.
Yeah, well, we removed it from them. They didn't have to worry about that. But you're...
And that's why Andrew and Zane have lots of money now, is because exactly. ModSec is painful.
That's where it's, I think you want to be as extensible to what is my CDN choice, right? Because the CDN choice is just as another similar conversation about what is my, you know, choice of Nginx versus HA proxy, right? What is my cloud provider?
Yeah.
Because if you go to CDN and you want to do split CDNs, you want to leverage, you know, a multi CDN to deliver different assets to different customers for better last mile for asset, you know, delivery. Those are all things that have to go into a decision for the company. And so what I really do love is that there's extensibility. I get to make the decision. And that's where from any product or any tool, giving a person buying product, the ability to build on top of, to make decisions, to use your APIs to drive extensibility to their organization. Those are the things that, you know, are really beneficial, I think, from that acquisition, because there's going to be customers that are just using, you know, Fastly CDN, and now they could just get SigSci day one, and they're going to be super happy with that decision. Because
it makes more sense for smaller shops, yeah, right? To have that sort of integration. And that brings me to the sort of final line of questioning I want to talk about. One thing that's really surprised me is, like, there's an Australian company very similar to Compass called REA Group, which is, I think, stands for Real Estate Australia. It's a very similar sort of website. I have a family member who actually works there, and they just have this massive dev team. I mean, I don't think they're 1,000 strong like you guys. They could be. But I'm really curious why a real estate listing website requires 1,000 developers, because just on the surface of it, it sounds like this should be a pretty simple website to run, right? Why 1,000 developers? Tell me.
So I think to take a step back, if you're looking at what Compass is looking to accomplish, it's the digitization of the entire real estate transaction, right? So when you start searching, to when you want to get your mortgage, to when you actually want to close, to
you're doing like settlements and finance as well, right?
Yeah, so it's going to be full stop shop, right? Yeah, okay. And so that's where that entire re-evolution or evolution of the real estate transaction moves away from these archaic processes that have kind of existed. On top of that, MLSs are region, city specific, state specific, and so there's 600 within the U.S. 600 data sources that I need to kind of pull in, use ETL, use Airflow, use our multiple, our large AI and ML team to start ingesting all this data and input it into a data store and make it useful, add context, add enrichment to it so that you could have a better search experience from just a consumer. That's just one piece of the hundreds of pieces that exist in the entire real estate transaction. And so if you look at the other, you know, products that exist out there, if you look at Zillow or Redfin, you search for it and then an agent reaches out to you. But no one's building out the tools to ensure that transaction can all be done within that platform, right? Your title and escrow, you collaborating and messaging back your agent.
JJ Agar, thank you so much for joining us to talk through a few things there about everything from your use of Signal Sciences, orchestration, et cetera, et cetera. It's been a really fun and illuminating chat. Thanks again.
Thank you, Patrick.
That was JJ Agar, CISO of Compass, there with a chat about automation, orchestration, and WAFs. Big thanks to him for that, and big thanks to Signal Sciences and Fastly for sponsoring this week's show. And that's it for this week's podcast. Before I go, I would like to mention that the Seriously Risky Business newsletter is back in business, and there'll be a fresh edition going out tomorrow, written by Tom Uren, our new editor. Do keep an eye out for that. I'll be back next week with more Risky Business, but until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.